John Dean, after your release from prison in 1975, you say you were given a lot of job offers, working for law firms, and an offer from a multinational corporation, but that you opted for what you term glory and greed. Now, what did you mean by that?
Well, I think that's being about as candid as one can be. And what I was talking about there is when I got home from prison, much to my surprise, there were countless offers of sort of a public nature. The reason I didn't, I go in the book through each of the reasons I didn't accept the law firms and the multinational and what have you. But the most logical opportunity seemed to be to first to one to go on a lecture tour that I had an invitation to do, and then secondly to write a book. I have often thought over the years that maybe that was a mistake, that maybe I should have weathered a little bit longer and kept a lower profile and tried to fade back into the woodwork, but I didn't.
Why did you have all these offers? Here was a man coming out of prison who was in an administration that had been dishonored. Was there some reason that made you so popular with all of these law firms?
That's a good question. I have never in my life looked for a job. They've always come to me, and they continue to this day. So I've been very fortunate. I touch wood.
You hired David Obst, the literary
David agent. Obst.
Obst.
Yeah.
And he lined up the lecture tour for you. So I guess you admit that, in effect, you began trafficking in Watergate.
To a degree. I think what I've always been sensitive to this whole issue of cashing in on Watergate. And I've been sensitive because, one, I wondered myself if it was right, but I had to reach some sort of understanding, and I did with myself. I said to myself, well, one, I can't invite myself to lecture anywhere, and I'm not going to be invited very many places unless I have something to say. And the same was true in writing a book. I thought to myself, well, I can't force anybody to buy that book. Anyone who has a problem feeling that's cashing in is obviously not going to buy the book. So if I have anything to say and people want it, then it will be read. I'm fortunate, it seems, with the first book anyway, that I had something that people wanted to hear, and it didn't seem to trouble them that that it dealt with a subject that evidenced my own involvement and others in misdeeds and malfeasance and nonfeasance at a pretty high level. The other interesting observation I'd like to share is that I've always been surprised, and I think this is, I've over the years decided is basically a media issue, that the media has seemed much more concerned than people I meet in daily life. I mean, people in the business of news gathering and what have you. But it always strikes me as odd that they single out those who were involved in Watergate for writing about the Nixon presidency and seem to forget that almost every presidency people write books about. And I probably would have written a book about the Nixon presidency had I not been involved in Watergate. And I would have much rather written the other book.
Well, in Last Honor, of course, you wrote about the days that followed your term in prison and the events leading up to, to the present day. What's next? Is there another Watergate book in you?
Well, I in writing this book, I feel Watergate's somewhat of a backdrop, and it's really a much more of a personal story that comes through. I've looked at Watergate to see what it all meant and what its impact was on not only myself but the presidency and the Congress and the American public, and dealt with some of the myths that have grown up around it. But in doing that, I hopefully have enabled myself anyway to put Watergate on the shelf. I'm sure others will write about it in the future, and I think it's important they do so we not totally shelve it. But for myself, I think not.
John Dean, have you ever sought to be readmitted to the bar?
Haven't. I think it was obviously right that I was disbarred as a young lawyer for the mistakes I made. Most of those who were lawyers who were involved in Watergate and got disbarred and have wanted their license back have gotten it back. Bud Krogh, Don Segretti, Herb Kalmbach, Gordon Strawn, a number of them have been able to practice. It's just that I haven't been sure I wanted to go through the agony that might entail. I've testified in a number of bar proceedings for these individuals, and it always surprises me how some of those who are passing judgment, one, even though they're lawyers, have a lot of trouble grasping the reality of the facts, and they come with their own preconceived notions of the facts. And they're confused about who the players are, who did what, when, and how. They're not particularly interested in uncovering the evidence to find out what really happened. So it's a rather visceral judgment that they decide upon with their preconceived notions on these individuals. And with one case, I was supposed to testify for an hour and ended up testifying for 8 hours to educate the bar examiners on what really was involved. And as I said, it wasn't for myself, but someone else. I might someday, however, try to get my license back.
Is this a proper way of disciplining errant lawyers by stripping the culprit of his livelihood forever?
Well, it seems that very little thought is given that by bar committees. I mean, they certainly in my own instance, it was the proceeding was a kangaroo court. I was prepared to turn in my license. My lawyer at the time, Charlie Schaffer, thought that we should put up a fight. I said, Charlie, it's a hopeless case. I mean, there's just no way. And when we realized they'd already written their opinion before the hearing, I knew that it was nothing but a kangaroo court. So it's whether that whole restriction or that retribution or whatever it is that the bar committees were seeking will be permanent, I don't know. It hasn't been with the others. It might be with myself. I don't know about John Mitchell or Richard Nixon or John Ehrlichman, who also were stripped of their license, whether they'll ever get theirs back or not either.
Obviously,
they're not as likely to practice, I might add, as I would be.
Obviously, your testimony before the Senate Watergate Committee helped to bring down the Nixon presidency, and you were not alone in going to jail. What, after the years have passed, do you have any kind of relationship with these conspirators today?
Well, I must first answer that question by saying that I really wasn't particularly close to a lot of these people when I was at the White House. I mean, we weren't social friends. And in talking to other people who've worked at other White Houses, I've learned that very seldom after an administration ends do former White House staff members continue with close associations. You know, that you have friends that you continue to be friendly with, as I do with the Nixon White House. But by and large, I've seen and talked to most everybody with the exception of Nixon, and I've never had occasion to either see or talk to him.
Are these other people angry with you?
They don't seem to be, no. I mean, a lot of Watergate, I think, clearly was politics, and we were on opposing political sides, if you will. And I think that they have put it in that context.
What was your remark recently when Nixon held the, I believe it was the 10th anniversary of his landslide election? You made a remark about not being invited. What was that?
Well, what happened is a reporter found me and asked me for my response. And I said, I'm not even sure what you're talking about. And he explained. He said, well, how do you feel about that whole anniversary or celebration? I said, well, I'm frankly a little surprised to learn that there'd be a class reunion of a school for scoundrels, which I was. And frankly, I don't think I would have attended if I was invited. I find it very odd that there would be a celebration 10 years later of Mr. Nixon's overwhelming 1972 election victory, when that victory was built on dirty tricks and Watergate. Now, how you could celebrate that, I don't know. I don't think the fellows who put it together really thought very much about it. They should have found a better reason to get together than that.
In Lost Honor, you identify the ex-conspirators by certain labels. Do you remember off the top of your head what those labels are?
Sure.
And, can you perhaps give us a couple of examples? We can't go through everybody, but...
Well, I talk about first the Stonewallers, and those are the ones who have really said nothing over the years, or just the minimal, that really haven't acknowledged any wrongdoing and don't seem in their own mind to accept that they've done anything wrong. And the two that stand out in that category are, of course, Richard Nixon and John Mitchell. They have continued over the years to really stonewall it. Why? I think probably, as I say in the book, because they were the oldest. They had the most to lose. They'd fallen the furthest. They were the ones in the most difficult position to start anew, and indeed probably chose not to. So they have pretended pretended as if nothing happened. At the other end of the spectrum, we have, of course, people I call the soldiers of misfortune, somewhat tongue-in-cheek, referring to Gordon Liddy and Howard Hunt, who seem to treat their conduct as just an embarrassment of botching a job. In fact, Gordon Liddy, who has virtually trivialized Watergate by going out and doing a road show where he talks about how he planned to murder everybody by sticking pencils in their throat that would go into their brain and horrifying audiences with this kind of talk and playing Mr. Macho. So it's those are the two ends of the spectrum, and as I say, that I really didn't find I fit into any of the categories, the other categories being those who sought a low profile, people like Bud Krogh and David Young and Dwight Chapin, who just sort of went on and got their career started again and tried to disappear, and when the press came after them, to answer no questions, to even to the extreme of David Young, if a newspaper man comes in one door, he goes out the other. Another example of a category I put people in were, of course, those who I called the redeemed, and that would be Chuck Colson and Jeb Magruder, who from disgrace found grace in their becoming born-again Christians, and I certainly applaud and in a way are very envious of the way they've handled the mistakes they made. But as I said also, I didn't fit into any of those categories. And this book is about how I found myself and where I came out in this whole situation.
Well, in a nutshell, can you define a category to put yourself in?
Yeah, I guess lost honor is where it fits. And honor is something that we really are given a certain amount of to start out in life, and we can either build on it or subtract from it. And I have managed to subtract mine by coming involved in Watergate. But I also say that through the years, in my ability to talk candidly, openly, and brutally honestly about what happened and myself and my involvement, to look back at my mistakes, to analyze them as to why I made them, and why I hopefully won't make them again. In doing that, it's given me a feeling of my own self-esteem in that honesty. So while I may have lost my honor, I certainly found my own esteem. And that's important for daily life.
Very briefly, there's an anecdote that I thought was kind of interesting in Lost Honor, and that was where you were approached by, I believe it was the National Enquirer, with some reputed Nixon love letters obtained by Scott Meredith. Can you just tell us about that?
It was a bizarre story. A reporter from the Enquirer started tracking me down and following me across the country, and finally getting a hold of me in Seattle, where he showed up in my room and told me that he had acquired allegedly, love letters written by Richard Nixon to a Contessa in Spain. He said they had tracked down who they thought the Contessa was. They had visited her. They had feelings that they were right. And they wanted me to look at these letters and see if I thought they were Richard Nixon's handwriting or sounded like Richard Nixon. I read the letters, and they were really somewhat classless. They were not anything that will someday be published, even if they were Richard Nixon's. They were, and I don't believe they are, but they were fairly graphic, fairly descriptive, fairly crude, but they also showed a Richard Nixon, if they were him, which I didn't believe at the time, don't now, that was open, was honest, was self-effacing, was able to see his errors. So I read these, and I learned more about them as the evening went on with this reporter, and he told me the most bizarre story about how he'd acquired them from somebody that is almost too long to explain on radio, but it's so bizarre it's almost a humorous read. And
well, what's the upshot? What happened to the letters?
What happened to the letters? They're still out there as a question mark. A few years ago, saw
still up for sale.
Apparently, they're still up for sale, and several people believe them to be real and true. I must say that I don't. I don't think they work. I don't think they are Richard Nixon's letters.
Nixon and the Contessa is a little hard to imagine.
That's right.
Well, this leads me to the final question or two, and I was going to avoid it because it's already been out, but I found that it filled up so much of your book I couldn't. So I'm going to have to ask you this.
It's less than 15% of the book.
How did that happen? Did the search for Deep Throat come as a second thought or what?
Throughout the book, there is this.
I mean, did you plan that when you wrote the book?
Yeah. Throughout the book, there is this this mystery story that winds through it, because it's a mystery story that has been winding through my life for the last 6 years, and that is the question: who was the source that supplied Bob Woodward of the Washington Post with all of his inside information? The source that would be dubbed Deep Throat. Well, through a process of elimination, I conclude and certainly convince myself that it is. There only can be one person who qualifies, and that's Alexander Haig. It was a process where I had some clues from my own sources, a source I developed in the Washington Post called Deep Thought. I think I was the first one to really sift through the evidence to see who could stand up. And in the weeks since this has been public, something curious has happened. In talking to reporters, particularly reporters who are serious Watergate buffs, their initial reaction, they told me, was, oh, that can't be. And they, like I, you know, guessed, they had their own candidate. They were guessing. When they realized that I'm not guessing, but rather have sifted through a mass of material to eliminate this down, to show how only one person can qualify, they become very persuaded. They say it's a compelling case, and if you're not right, they see that no one else really stands up. So I'm slowly but surely, a lot of people are now, because they're looking at the book, beginning to understand why it is that only Al Haig qualifies. Now, if it isn't Al Haig, of course, the other option is a composite character. I don't believe that, though. It was my first instinct. It's something I had to fight all the way along in this mystery story, denying to myself that, well, I had to really assume that when I looked Woodward in the eyes on a number of occasions, had conversations with him, that he was being totally truthful in saying it was one source. What confirmed that for me was Woodward at one point, because of a problem in his role as the Metro editor, had had to tell his editor, the senior editor, Ben Bradley, who Deep Throat was. And my source, Deep Thought, told me indeed Bradley does know who it is, and it is one person. So I think that the only one person that makes it and could have possibly known all the information that the Deep Throat gave Woodward, and it's not very much, but it's very unique information, was Al Haig.
One last question. Why do you think, at this point, the search for Deep Throat is important?
Well, the reason I pursued it and bothered to write it in the book is because, one, it's been the question I've been most asked over all these years. I mean, everywhere I've gone, people wanted to know who this was. And when I started, I thought it was just an interesting sort of Watergate trivia question, which is the way it's been treated. But when I began analyzing and thinking about some of the things that had happened, I realized over the years a number of young people in particular have come up to me and asked me questions based on information they've gotten out of Woodward's book that's from Deep Throat, and they take it as fact. And it's not fact. Deep Throat made a lot of errors, a lot of speculation on awful lot of material is dead wrong and shown clearly by the evidence to be so. So I thought, one, I could clean up this hole. I could answer the question, clean up the facts, and I guess the third reason was it was just a good mystery story and fun to unravel.
Maybe it's time to take the flower pot off the terrace now.
Hopefully.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.